If you've ever seen a fish market, either on TV, like the one in Seattle where they throw the fish, or if you've seen one in person, you probably know there's more than a few choices of fish. Cooks get kind of crazy when thinking about all the possibilities. It's easy to be overwhelmed by choice of product and to be confused about just what to do with it. Today's episode is the continuation of the Escoffier series, and today is the fish chapter. We'll cover some fish basics before we get into the various ways to cook some of the various fish, and there's a lot of fish. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 227, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. Frequent listeners to this show know I also like history. I'm in the early part of Patrick Newman's book, Cronyism, Liberty versus Power in Early America, and it's very well done. Patrick probably lost friends over this book. Maybe not. I hope not. Based on what I've read so far, I recommend it to you, U.S. history fans. The Escoffier series continues. Chapter 6, Fish. It's an old joke. What do you call a fish with no eye? Fish. I want to do a brief fish primer first. Now, Escoffier included shellfish in this chapter, and that's probably going to be a separate episode. Fish can be classified a few different ways. One way is by water source or water type, freshwater or saltwater. The other main classification is shape, round fish or flat fish. Salmon and trout and perch are examples of round fish. Sole, halibut, and flounder are examples of flat fish. Sole and flounder are mostly the same size commercially. They taste different, a little bit. Halibut is big. Halibut is really big, much bigger than a flounder. Turbot is a fly fish also, but mostly only in Europe. I don't recall seeing it in U.S. restaurants, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there, and I certainly didn't see it at the Fulton Fish Market when it was still in downtown New York. Fish butchery is a skill and one that will not be easily or well conveyed in a podcast. As with any meat cutting endeavor, a sharp knife is by far the most important tool. A whole round fish, a salmon, will yield two sides. They look just like the side of a fish. You've seen them, pictures of them. Grouper, scamp, mahi-mahi, amberjack, trout, perch are all round fish, and they all have two sides. Sole, halibut, turbot, and flounder are flat fish, and they have four. The top and the bottom of the flounder are, of course, sides, but the configuration of the fish means that the top has two identical, just opposite sides, and so the same on the bottom. Now, that's more for information than it is to be frustrating or confusing, and there's almost no chance you'll have to worry about cutting a whole sole or a whole flounder from your local grocery store. But it is relevant when we start talking about thickness of the fish, and that's going to be very fundamental in the cooking time and process and particular procedure. If you leave the salmon whole and cut portions through the whole fish, bones and all, that's a steak. There is the issue of removing the bones and leaving the salmon steak appearing intact, but Steaks will cook a bit more evenly since they're uniform in size. They also make an interesting presentation. Grouper steaks, well, it's possible, but unlikely due to the very large size of the grouper. Now, I suppose now at the tail end you could do that. That would be interesting. Well, with grocery stores being what they are, it seems a rare thing to find a whole fish at the meat counter. Even if you do find one, there's a decent chance someone there can fillet it for you. Skin can be edible. It isn't always, and usually it's better when it's made crisp. Most skin, in my experience, if it's not made crisp, I think, as an American, we Americans tend to find the texture of fish skin, even cooked fish skin, a little bit unsettling, a little unappealing, but crispy is very good. So crispy skin is a cooking technique we might get to, and we'll see how that goes. Scales on fish are not edible, at least as far as I'm concerned, with at least this single caveat. The scales on little tiny rainbow trout are so tiny, and both in width, they're nearly non-existent. So on a case like that, no one would scale it. You just eat the whole thing. Now, take the bones out, of course. Smelt, another one. Bones, I wouldn't eat the head, but I certainly wouldn't eat the guts, but bones and scales and fins and all on smelt because they're so tiny and puny. Skin and bones and heads are excellent items for fish stock or fish fumet. Now, the difference there is subtle, and I might have covered that in the stocks episode. Maybe not, but it's not super relevant right now. Heads do need some attention, and this part upcoming can get icky. Jump ahead 10 or 15 seconds if talk of bloody bits is too much. Gills contain a lot of blood, which serves no useful purpose in stocks. Cut them out with scissors and remove any large blood clots you find in the head. A quick rinse underwater is fine. Trout and perch heads are small, but salmon or steelhead trout heads can get large, so those heads should be cut in half, like through the chin down through the brain, and then also rinse that out to get the blood clots out. Fish stocks follow the same basic process as all stocks. Start the bones in cold water, bring it to a boil, skim the scum, reduce the heat to a simmer, then add the vegetables and aromatics. Sometimes that's called a bouquet garni or a sachet in the last few minutes. Fish stocks, in my opinion, should not cook more than half an hour, 45 minutes at the most, but to me that's pushing it. All right, on to the book. As to the cooking of fish, there are 8 ways Escoffier lists to cook fish. Drink of water. Cooking in salted water, poaching, braising, cooking au bleu, deep frying, cooking à la manière, grilling, and cooking au gratin. What seems to be missing is sautéing. It's going to be covered a little bit in Meunier, and I'm actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. Also, as we get into some of the processes and procedures, a fair amount of fish cookery is intended, or was intended, to be cooked on the gueridon. That's the tableside cooking thing. It is one heck of a show, and it really is, because the maitre d', or the captain, the waiter captain, that person not only has to do all the cooking, like the chef would do, or the cook would do, has to do it with grace and aplomb. And so that's why it's a heck of a show. I'm going to go through the various cooking procedures that Escoffier mentioned. Some might be less plain than others. Poaching is easy enough. And he also offers some ideas of poaching liquids called court bouillon. I can't get the nasally French part. A court bouillon is a flavorful liquid of water and acid, aromatics, and flavorings. Acid can be either wine or vinegar, and the key for Escoffier is the function of that acid. The key distinction, as I can find it in the reading, is a vinegar copion is for whole fish, you know, he says salmon or trout, and a wine copion, it can be either red wine or white wine, depending on the fish and the final preparation, is for smaller fish or portions of fish. Yeah, there is a procedure for a shellfish corpignon, which is just a bit saltier than a regular corpignon, and a plain corpignon, which is made to order for the poached fish and consists of water, whole milk, lemon slices, and salt. The fish he cites for this are large cuts of turbot and brill. Now, if your first thought is, holy crap, that's a lot of corpignons just to poach a fish. Yes, it is. I don't think nearly all of them are necessary. I think what's necessary is one. And white wine is as good as vinegar. Probably better because you might if you're going to be using white distilled white vinegar that you add to the little pellets for your Easter eggs, that's the only reason that vinegar is any good, or for cleaning out the coffee machine. It is not meant to be consumed. So white wine or red wine, and it might be kind of make, it probably won't make pink fish, but wouldn't that be fun? Each type of copion does have a slightly different list of ingredients. Now, to make that part easy, I would make one kind of copion and use carrots, celery, onions, fennel bulb, which is distinguished from the stems and the fronds, and the white of leek rounds. Thyme, parsley stems, black peppercorns, and bay leaf would be the seasonings. The vegetables would be the aromatics. Cut the vegetables pretty thin. Add water. Cut the vegetables pretty thin, period. Add water just to cover the bones, bring that to a boil, reduce to a simmer, and of course skim the scum. Now cook that, depending on the quantity, for 20-25 minutes. Add the aromatics, the vegetables, cook another 10 minutes, add the seasonings, the bay leaf and the thyme and the parsley stems, another 5 minutes, then take it off the heat. Strain it and cool it, or then use it right then and there if you're going to be making, you know, lunch or dinner. After it is strained, I would add some salt. I wouldn't add salt in the beginning because I don't know how much it's going to reduce. And that's not really the main point. You can add more water to it when you're done. Poached fish can be served hot or cold. I think... this isn't the thing anymore. This was a really big deal back in the 80s and in the 70s even more so. Cold poached salmon used to be a really big deal. And for food show types, they would take the cold poached salmon, sometimes the whole side, and then put something called chauffoir on it, which is a white gelatin coating. And then the chef garmager would make a pretty... we hope pretty, decorative scene on the side of the fish, generally relevant to a fish thing, so maybe an underwater scene. They cover that with aspic, and that would be part of the centerpiece for a buffet, for a Sunday brunch, with then, you know, smoked salmon, salmon mousse, maybe nowadays salmon tartare, small, cold, poached small poached cervical. I can't say that. Pieces of salmon, and then the daring folks would cut that apart, the pretty one, and that would be also edible. But I'm not sure anybody does that anymore. When I was at the Ritz-Carlton, we had, we're still talking now, not about brunches, about poaching. At the Ritz-Carlton Naples, we had very pretty copper poissonniere. Now, that might be mispronounced. It was a little, I think if it was a foot wide, that was a lot, and oval shaped with handles, with not separate attached handles. This is hard to explain. The metal was configured in a way that the whole thing was the handles on the end were part of that single piece of metal. And so there were copper outside, stainless steel inside, and maybe 4 inches deep in the tight-fitting lid. And inside, there was a little tray that was just slightly smaller in oval size than the vessel itself. It had holes in it so that steam could come up through it. And they had hooks isn't the right word, but it had handly things configured in a way that it would attach to the handles of the copper poissonnier to hold that little metal tray up. It would keep the fish out of the corbillon at the bottom, so that the flavor of the corbillon and in the form of steam as it's cooking the fish would also impart itself into the fish. And boy, they were cool. A lot of fun. They got hot, but they were fun to play with. So the Ritz-Carlton dining room, very clever name, they used gyrodons for all food delivery. There weren't any trays. And part of the reason for that is presentation. The poissonnier finished one is put in the window, and the expediter, the captain, puts that on the gyrodon, also with an empty plate. And the whole dinner, let's say it's a foretop, the other plates, everything has a silver cloche on top, including the empty plate. And the captain gets to the table, opens the poissonnier, delicately takes the fish off of that little tray, puts it on the plate. Oh, and so we've also given him a gravy boat of sauce for the fish. Inside the poissonnier in the liquid are the veg for that particular plate. And he knows or she knows how to arrange the vegetables on the plate so it looks the way we designed it. And then sauces the fish, and then cloches the plate again. Now, every table, regardless of how many people there are, all plates are served to the guests at the same time. So you have an A-top, you've got eight waiters. And plates go down, and with some training and skill, they know on 1, 2, 3, all of the cloches are lifted at the same time, so everybody sees and smells their meal at the same time. It's really a very impressive show. Really very cool. So that was steamed fish. The poaching of fish, the significant difference is that there is a temperature difference. Poaching is 160 to 180, simmers 180 to 200, and boiling is 200 to 212 at sea level. That changes a bit up here. So poaching is the lowest temperature where the heat exchange can actually cook the thing. And the reason poaching is better than simmering is it's less violent. The more that water rolls, the more damage it's going to do to the stuff in the water. So poaching is better. And you want something that has some flavor. That's what the corpion is for. So when we read through some of the procedures for poaching fish, now, remember, Escoffier had an army of cooks. Some of the procedures include putting the fish on that perforated tray, no, he would call it a grill, and submerge the fish halfway in the corpione and baste it frequently while it's in the oven. Well, that sounds hot. No one has the time for that, certainly not in today's commercial kitchens. That's just too much fussiness. Now, you could do it at home, but it's not going to happen in a restaurant. One idea Escoffier does not put forth is, sorry, he does put forth, misread it, is to use some of the poaching liquid, which will have a lot of fish flavor, as a sauce. So from that container, whatever you're using to poach your fish, if it's in the oven, or even not in the oven, take a couple of ounces of that liquid, put it into a small pan on a medium hot burner, and add a tablespoon of butter to that. And swirl the pan around, not too quickly. You don't want to splash it out. And the heat of the burner will melt the butter, but it's also going to sort of, it won't hold, but it will emulsify for a few minutes into that poaching liquid. So it's going to do what classical French sauces are famous for. It's going to enrich the flavor of the sauce because you're adding butter. The butter brings out the flavor of things. It also adds a velvety texture to things. And so that's a really nice way to make and finish a sauce for a poached or steamed fish. So moving on to braised fish. Now, the way he writes it, braised fish is recommended for large whole fish or large pieces of larger fish, like a side of turbot or a half of a side of turbot or a salmon or possibly even a whole grouper, which is interesting because Escoffier doesn't mention grouper anywhere. Now, I can only guess, at least maybe, that's because it wasn't a fish found in France or it went by a different name. Neither of those things is really particularly important because we have grouper here. The procedure, Escoffier writes, for braising is a little bit unclear, which is really frustrating. Braise, to me, suggests sear first because that's what you would do with, say, ossobuco or any other, like or short ribs. You'd brown them first because you want that flavor, you want that caramel into the sauce. Escoffier doesn't indicate, is searing part of the procedure? He does write that it is a good procedure for large fish. The chief distinction here is the fish is covered three quarters of the way with red wine or white wine, as suits the fish and the final product and the final sauce. And the other, so you're filling it, I can't do three quarters divided by two, I don't know what that is. So half wine, half stock. Fish is on the bottom of the pan and not on a grill, not raised up off the bottom of the pan at all. Then in the oven, basting frequently. When the fish is nearly cooked, remove it to a platter to keep warm. Strain the cooking liquid. Let it settle a little bit to remove any fat. Well, what fat? Well, Escoffier, if it was, in some cases would have used fat back as a way to put fat into the fish if it was a lean fish. Salmon is not a lean fish, would not get bacon, but not get fat back. So strain, lift that fat off of your rested sauce, rest it for a minute, fish is still hot. Reduce that liquid as necessary, typical Escoffier language, and add that to the fish sauce. Now, that's a lot of confusion, I get it. So we have this braised fish nearly done, we've taken it out. Now, here's the thing that he doesn't really talk about. If we're not using a grill, if the fish is on the bottom of the pan, and the pan's hot, and the fish is hot, and the liquid's hot, how in the heck to get the fish out? If this is something you want to try, my recommendation would be either aluminum foil, which has the risk of possibly coloring from the acid of the wine, or
You know, it would work. This would work. Cheesecloth. Won't color from the wine, and it will hold. So that would be my suggestion, is something to lift the fish out without burning yourself and risking damaging the fish, because what's the point of doing that? So cook the fish, mostly done. Lift it out, strain the sauce, lift the fat off, reduce that to the consistency and flavor that matches the final product or final dish you're making, which is what he means, add that reduced liquid to the fish sauce, because you're going to be making a particular dish and that flavor is going into the sauce, which is already made, so it needs to be of the same consistency so you don't thin it out. Now you're done. A lot of work. It's a lot of work. I will tell you, I have never once done this kind of fish cooking. I have cooked fillets of fish in ingredients intended to be the sauce / garnish, and by the way, I did brown them first. The one example I can think of is a dish called Grouper Brisbane. Now, this is not an Escoffier dish. I'm pretty sure it isn't codified in any way. For all I know, Brisbane's the cook's mom's middle name. It came from a place in Bradenton, Florida, a billion years ago, and I liked it. It was mostly a tomato-based sauce with kiwi. Yeah, it sounds odd, but it worked. And maybe black olives. It's been nearly 40 years, and the details are fuzzy. That restaurant is also the restaurant on Mother's Day weekend where upstairs in the mostly empty bar, I sang Highway to Hell with the house band. That part I remember. Braising fish is a good way to get flavor into the fish, and I recreated that group of Brisbane at a job at a hotel in Michigan and got a fair amount of crap for it, but I don't care. I seared it first, turned it over so the service side was up, added the ingredients to the pan, which would end up being the sauce, and it finished it in the oven. So that's braising. And doing it the way I did, I think, is a perfectly fine way to go with that. Now, procedure 1556, I'm not going to discuss. I mentioned it at the top. It's called The Cooking of Fish au Bleu. And if you want to learn about it, look it up. The procedure is not for the timid. Moving on, deep frying is maybe the most popular way to eat fish. Therefore, it's the most popular way to cook fish. There are more than a few ways to fry fish and more than a few ways to bread or batter fish. Escoffier does not address battered fish. And sounds kind of mean. He recommends the fish be small enough to cook quickly in the fat. Too large of a piece of fish risks burning the breading on the outside and the fish not being done on the inside. That idea, too big to cook, is why many times if you see whole fried fish on a menu, it will be cut through the flesh on both sides of the fish so that there's even distribution of heat and the whole thing cooks at the same time. Some keys about frying: don't overcrowd the fry basket. The fish should be well submerged, but also when you jiggle the basket, you want the fish to be able to sort of move around, because sometimes fish come to the top and if it's too crowded, the fish can't move around and get even cooking, and then we'll get soggy breading and nobody wants that. The smaller your fish piece, the higher the fry temperature can be. But, says I, a maximum high temperature is probably 375. I wouldn't go higher than that for a variety of reasons. One, your fryer may not actually go that high. Two, it can risk burning the breadcrumbs before the inside is done, even on thin fish. But mostly it's just, there's no reason to go higher than that. Now, Escoffier suggests the classic three-step breading process: flour, egg wash, breadcrumbs. I find that inferior. The fish seems always to create steam, which makes a gap between the breading and the fish. I prefer soaking the fish. Now, we make fish fingers here. Fish don't have fingers, but we make fingers in seasoned buttermilk, and I let it sit for about 15 minutes. Now, seasoned is just, I don't buy seasoned buttermilk. I invented a thing I call Daddy-O seasoning. It's kind of like Lowry's, except there's no sugar because I can't stand all the added sugar and everything. And I think it tastes pretty good. So season the buttermilk, add the fish to that, let it sit 15 minutes in the refrigerator, lift the fish out, place it into a cornmeal flour mixture, seasoned, of course. Cover that well. So you're going to, let's say if you're a right-handed person, you lift the fish out of the bowl in the buttermilk with the left hand, place it into the bowl or plate or whatever you're working in of the flour mixture. And with the right hand, drizzle, you know, give the bowl a shake, drizzle some of the flour cornmeal mixture on top. Turn the fish over, try to avoid getting the buttermilk on your right hand. You're trying to keep two distinct hands here. Turn the fish over, give it a pat to make sure that all of the flour mixture is pushed into all the parts of the buttermilk so that it all sticks. Then lift it out of there, give it a gentle shake, and lay it out on a metal rack on a sheet pan. The sheet pan is there to catch any bits of flour that might fall off, and also there to give and you want as much air around that fish as possible. And actually, you want as much air around your eggplant slices, your zucchini slices, your chicken slices, whatever you're making and you're breading for frying. You want to put it flat on a pan because that flat on the pan spot, the liquid and the flour or the breading is going to get soggy and it won't fry. And I'm saying there's a good possibility it might stick to the pan, in which case all of it's gone. So on a rack, it has a chance to get air around it. And as it sits there, the dry thing, breadcrumbs or flour, cornmeal, is absorbing the liquid thing and helping it stay attached. So when you fry it, it stays on the fish or the chicken and doesn't go to the bottom of the fryer, which is the whole goal of doing all this. So once you've done all your fish, laid it out so it can touch but not overlap on the sheet pan. You might need to put that in the cooler, 15 minutes. Now you can go fry them. Don't overcrowd your fryer. And one hand at a time. In the case of frying fresh fish, fryer baskets in the fat, and then gently don't drop. It can be kind of scary till you get used to it. Take one piece to hold the top of the fish, whatever's going to be the top, and slowly lower the fish into the fat and then let go before your fingers go in. If you take those same breaded fish on the sheet pan, on the rack, put them in the freezer, let them freeze solid, give them an hour, give them two, they should very easily, maybe a little bit gingerly of help, come off of that sheet pan. Then you can put it into a Ziploc bag and you've got frozen breaded fish for a quick dinner. If that's the case, you can lift the baskets out of the fat, rest them on the edge with the little hook, place three or four, depending on the size, I don't know how big they are, pieces of fish in the basket, then lower the basket into the fryer and cook them till they're done. You can also parblanch your french fries and freeze them the same way, so you've got homemade french fries ready to fry up. For all of the ways you can prep a fish, it doesn't have to be buttermilk. I like the flavor of buttermilk, and I like what the acid does to the protein, breaks it down a little bit. It can be regular milk. You could use yogurt. You could use sour cream. You can invent a whole new liquid. The thing that goes into the liquid, if you're gluten-free, man, there's 40 different kinds of flour you can play with. So there's lots of other ways to go with what's on the outside. I like the cornmeal because I like the way that crunches. One item to mention about frying fish. The oil will taste like fish. So if you're having a fish fry, make hush puppies. Make some French fries too, because they'll taste like fish anyway. I do fry fish now and again, and I don't change the fat just because I fried fish. Chicken or potatoes after the fish aren't much diminished for it, and I can assure you that your favorite fish fry house doesn't have a dedicated fish fryer, especially if they have French fries and fish, chicken. It's just, they're not doing it. Nearly any white-fleshed fish that isn't too oily is a good choice for deep frying. Now, salmon is neither white nor lean, so I wouldn't deep fry salmon. Mackerel or mullet are white-ish and fatty. I wouldn't deep fry either one of those. Grouper, cod, snapper would work, but I can't bring myself to tell you to do that because it just seems like some kind of a violation. It's just not right. Just something you don't do to snapper. You don't make snapper fingers. Pollock, haddock, those are good choices. Regardless of what you are frying, keeping the fryer clean is a good step toward preserving your oil, and peanut oil is kind of spendy, and also avoiding black bits, which is burnt stuff, ending up on your food. You can find, if you've ever seen a tea strainer, the mesh is almost like solid metal. The holes are minuscule. It's designed that way on purpose. You can find slightly larger mesh strainers of the same kind of almost solid metal looking screen and a metal handle and metal frame, no plastic please, and that very, very fine mesh strainer is a really good way to, you just run that through, take the baskets out, run that through your fat, and that will lift out all of the floaty bits. If you give the hot fat carefully, because it can splash. If you give the hot fat a little bit of convection by moving it rapidly, you can get some of the bits from the bottom to come to the top, and you can get some of those bits out also. For a real thorough cleaning of the fat, your local restaurant supply house will sell, it comes in a box, I think, of 50. Looks like a giant cone coffee filter. And then there's a stainless steel holder for this thing. And what that is, that cone, is a fryer fat filter. So, first thing you'll need after the fryer fat filter and the fryer fat filter holder is a place to put the hot fat. No plastic buckets, please. You would think that wouldn't need to be mentioned, but alas, there's always that one cook who just doesn't pay attention. No, it wasn't me. Oh, and don't reach your hand into a fryer that is turned on. Even if the oil is cloudy, and some fryer fats are cloudy before they're fully hot, the fat can still be hot enough to burn. Yeah, different cook. Phil, first day of culinary school, and he ends up bandaged halfway up his forearm for nearly the whole semester. Don't put your hand in a deep fryer. I'm going to skip procedure 1558, cooking a la meuniere, not because it's icky, but because it's maybe the most famous fish cooking procedure and can be done tableside for an amazing presentation or usually done in the kitchen. There really is a right way and a wrong way to do this, and I'm going to save that for fish part two. There are a few other procedures, maybe less famous than this one, but they are worth covering. The last procedure I'm going to address, I'm going to avoid crimping because it's mostly an English thing, and, well, we're not English. And there's nothing wrong with English. They're perfectly fine people. The last one I'm going to cover is grilling. Seems simple enough. Salmon is a great fish to grill. It is worth mentioning that restaurant grills are pretty stinking hot. That means the heat is an important ally for getting the fish to release, and home grills, even the gas ones, I don't think have the same BTU. Now, I don't know what that is, but there's a lot of BTUs coming out of those gas grills at a restaurant. So the heat is an ally to helping that fish release. So too is good prep. A clean grill grate is vital, so good grill brush, and a rag with some oil to grill, to oil the grill grate. Ugh, too many words. Lightly oiled fish, even salmon, is important also. We would have used regular olive oil in these kinds of things, and for probably all sautéing. For if you at home, olive oil is fine. If you've got ghee, well, that's fine too. That would be good. Something oil, something not seed oil, please. Avocado oil, kind of seed, but olive oil is fine. Butter, clarified butter is fine. Bacon fat's fine. That would taste good. So lightly oiled fish, seasoned fish, that's important. And the last thing that really makes a big difference here in getting the fish off the grill without leaving bits behind is the right tool. Now, I've made no secret about my hatred for tongs. They do more harm than help, and they do the harm by cutting the food, or the sharp edges will tear the food or break the food if you squeeze too tightly. They are no help here either. What is useful is a fish spatula, sometimes called the Peltex, or an 8-inch offset, we can use a 10-inch offset pastry spatula. Wood handles better than plastic over the grill, please. It probably won't surprise you that I'm no fan of those big, clunky commercial pancake spatulas. And the other tool, maybe the best thing for the grill, is a long, straight, tined fork. There are two tines. They sometimes, I know it sounds like times, T-I-N-E. Sometimes they're called tuning forks because they are straight as opposed to the carving fork, which usually has the tines are only about 3 or 4 inches and they're curved. And they look like teeth, like saber-tooth tiger teeth. You know, either one of those things are going to work. The thing we want to do here is that long fork is going to fit between the grates of the grill, and you can use that to gently make sure the fish is releasing from the grill. The fish, the chicken, whatever it is, will release from the grill when the sear on the grill part has reached a high enough point that it's going to release. I have no idea when that happens, but it does. The same thing works on a griddle. Put the food on there, and you have to have the patience to wait for the food to release itself, and it will do that. You can help it, but then it's a whole other show. Helping it too much leaves sticky bits behind, and then that causes a problem for the next thing you cook. So the salmon will release. Use your fork to reach underneath to help lift it up. Now, the turning, because everyone wants to see those good grill marks. So let's say you've put your salmon on the grill and the low part is the left side. So it's going at a 45 degree angle, left to right going up. And you have loosened it with your fork by getting in between the grill grates. To me, this is a two-handed job. The offset spatula in your left hand, I'm right-handed, the offset spatula in your left hand, the fork in your right hand, after you are sure it's all been released, lift the whole thing up, turn it. How many degrees is that? 45 degrees, 90 degrees. I'm not a geometry major. So that you make the nice grill mark, set that back down, let that cook some more. To turn it over, that part's a little bit easier. Now, I would use gravity in my favor, and I'm assuming the restaurant grills mostly lean down toward the cook, so the high part is at the back, and the lower part is in the front. That makes sense. So when the fish is ready to be turned, I would just, again, two-handed operation, holding the offset spatula in my left hand, use the fork, and just lift the fish up and let gravity do the work for me. And the spatula is in my hand just to make sure that it doesn't slide, because if it's oily, it's rare, but weird things happen. And being prepared to stop the weird thing from happening is better than not being prepared. So turn the fish over just by letting gravity help you turn the fish, make sure it doesn't slide down, finish cooking that way. Depending on the size of your fish, the heat of the grill, or the absence of heat on the grill, it's possible your fish will need to be finished in an oven. No big deal. Happens all the time. On the grill, whole fish, maybe a snapper, might need some help, just like we gave the whole fish that was in the deep fryer. A little bit of cuts through the flesh on both sides to make sure we get the even distribution of heat all the way around. If we don't do that, the risk is that we're going to burn the skin off completely, and still the inside might not be done. So we want to avoid that, and we want to keep a presentation. We don't want burned food. Nobody wants that. Now, Escoffier recommends a procedure I've tried once and to no success at all. Well, one time, big deal. Hang on. He writes that for small pieces of white lean fish, coat them in flour, then brush with butter, then grill. It would seem, in your mind's eye, that the butter would drip off, flare up, and black smoke would color the fish. It did. He writes that the flour should make a nice crust, and that was nothing at all close to my experience. So, because of the first time, I didn't bother with the second time. You can probably see why. Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
Determining doneness of your fish might be an area that confounds more than a few cooks. Determining doneness is not helped by tuna being an outlier for doneness. Rare tuna is mostly hardly even warm in the center and not a hint of color change. Salmon is a little bit closer to normal. I find it is best served about medium. No doubt some of you have very strong feelings that medium is too much. Salmon does let itself to lend itself to a peek inside if you are cooking fillets. Whole fish is a different matter, but the fillet might be able to pull apart the muscle tissue a wee bit to peek inside and see, is this translucent or is it opaque? White-fleshed fish, perch, mahi-mahi, cobia, skate, grouper, or trout, which isn't always white, are better cooked just to done, which means the translucent look of the fish has turned opaque due to cooking, which is coagulation of proteins. Scamp, a kind of grouper, mostly out of the Gulf and mostly a bycatch to grouper fishing, and scamp and halibut are better cooked a little bit less, kind of like salmon. And as if all of this wasn't enough already, all fish does not cook at the same rate. 6 ounces of halibut or 6 ounces of scamp or 6 ounces of grouper will not be done the same after 6 minutes in the oven. Now, as if that wasn't enough to make it, I'm not going to forget it. I'm not cooking fish. those three fish, particularly the halibut and the scamp, are more alike than the scamp is to the grouper, even though they're in the same class. So halibut has a halibut's an amazing fish. Very similar in configuration to it's called Pentagoria sawtooth fish, and they had it at sea bass. The halibut, so you know, you've seen fish, you know its muscle fibers are like this, it's just they're next to each other, but they sort of fall apart. And grouper will do that a little bit, scamp will do that a lot of it. And scamp is buttery, like halibut's buttery. It's tender. The muscle tissue fibers are very, very fine, as opposed to grouper, which are a little bit bigger. And so the whole mouth feel of halibut and scamp is just amazing. And so when they go from cooked perfectly to overcooked in just seconds, and then it's like, it would have been great 10 seconds ago. Some fish can tolerate a little bit more heat than others, and scamp and halibut are two that don't like that. The other thing that is just going to add the final wrinkle to all this is, let's say you've got, so halibut's the flat fish, and it's going to end up having a tail piece, which is kind of thin. Scamp and grouper and salmon, it can either have a piece of portioned from the middle of the fillet, middle of the side, which is going to be nice and thick and take a few minutes to cook. If you get the tail piece, well, it's going to cook fairly quickly. So all of that stuff sort of plays into how long does it take to cook? Well, I can't tell you that because I don't know. Depends on the piece you have. It depends how hot your oven is. Depends how hot your pan was when you sauteed it. But I can tell you by looking at it to determine its doneness, pulling it out of the oven before it's actually where you think it should be, it will carry over cook some more. And I think a undercooked fish, a little bit undercooked, not a lot undercooked, is better than an overcooked fish. And there is no sauce that's going to fix, in my opinion, no sauce that's going to fix an overcooked fish. I mentioned tuna as an outlier in the very rare thing of barely cooked is overcooked. Monkfish, anglerfish to you Nemo fans, is another outlier in the complete opposite direction. It can take more heat than other fish. Now, it certainly can be overcooked, but it's going to be a firm fish no matter what you do to it. Monkfish has been called poor man's lobster for the visual similarity to the protein configuration and layout and texture, but not because of its flavor. Monkfish is a very good fish, but don't let the moniker confuse you. There is no way this is lobster. No one would ever make that mistake, but it is a good fish to eat. I said I'm going to leave a la meuniere procedure for next, as well as a few others of note, and so too it is that the shellfish mentioned at the top is going to be for next week. What is mostly so for many of the Escoffier's dishes is the cooking procedures are of a few, just repeated again and again, and the garnishes alone make a whole new dish. Now, a fair bit of that is going to be the case in the main courses, of course, starting with fish. We'll see that is so with meats and poultry as well. While there is repetition, the main things to take from classical French cooking is the attention to detail and what does each addition do to the dish. That is, how does each addition enhance or improve the dish? Now, Escoffier was by no means exhaustive. No doubt we can think of combinations he didn't think of, or at least didn't write down. But the idea that an extra ingredient should raise the dish to a higher level is simple enough. in the realm of creative writing, if it doesn't help, it hurts. Same thing here in our cooking. If we're adding something that doesn't help the dish, it necessarily is taking away from what was already a better dish. Now, I know that this is getting into, it sounds like it is. It's cook philosophy. And it's worth thinking about, but there isn't any final answer. There is. That's not true. There is a final answer. The final answer is you eating the food on the plate. If you like it, and you say, man, I have to do that again, then I'm done. You or your guests like the food you've made, then no one else has an opinion. Fantastic. That's a great job. Good for you. Good for them. Do it again, because it's fun to do. And maybe you can push it and get an even better dish out of it. That's amazing. But the philosophy part is thinking about what's going on in the pan, what's going to happen to the palate, how does all this stuff play together? And that only comes with lots of experience, and it doesn't, you know, that's just all it is. And just thinking about different combinations, different flavors, different textures, different temperatures. And then it becomes fun. All right, folks, that's going to do it. Valentine's Day is coming, and that's as good a reason as any to cook dinner. Buy a copy of my cookbook, Cooking for Comfort, with recipes that make way more than enough for two. So think lunches for next week. Find a link on the blog page, culinarylibertarian.com/cookingforcomfort. The beef roast, though, the beef stroganoff, pictured several times on that page, is easily the most popular dish so far from that book. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.